How many more 1 minutes do you need? You need a few?
If we just get to 6:10, that would be good.
Oh, okay. All right.
BC, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you all?
Doing well.
We have a quorum now, so we can start. Well, welcome. Welcome to Academic Affairs. It is a delight. I think we have a completely new committee, so new that I was the only person in attendance at the Academic Affairs Committee at the last meeting, and so I'm told it's very important that I vouch for the veracity as best I can of what the minutes say. And so doing so, I must say, please read those for your information, but we'll be making our own history, so it's okay. But it is a pleasure to know you. I'd like to ask that all of the trustees at the meeting take just a minute and introduce yourselves, if you would, please, because I haven't had the pleasure of meeting but one of you, I think. And I think it would be great if you don't know one another also. So just a few sentences about yourselves and what you bring as an interest to this committee would be wonderful to know. So let's start maybe with you, Michael, if you don't mind.
Sure. I'm Michael Dannenberg. Currently, the Deputy Commissioner for Policy in the Massachusetts Department of Higher Education, where, among other areas, I oversee development of policy related to student success. I've got over 25 years of experience, mainly at the federal level in education policymaking, working for the late Senators Claiborne Pell, Ted Kennedy, and after that, President Obama in the U.S. Department of Education. Happy to be here.
Fabulous. Good to have you. Who would like to go next? And is BC here?
Sure. Yeah, happy to jump in. BC Oyedele, I'm currently the Chief Executive Officer of an organization called Education Forward DC, which primarily a grant-making organization focused on advancing educational equity here in the district. My background is K-12 education, but I have worked in higher ed at Boston College, which is my alma mater. Spent most of my time in Massachusetts teaching and leading there, but our work right now involves supporting charter schools and District of Columbia public schools with, you know, the primary K-12 focus, improving academic outcomes, but also thinking about post-secondary pathways and the work that they're doing to ensure that students are on a path to long-term success. So nice to be with you all.
Wonderful. Tracy Jackson. Has she made it on?
She is. Good evening.
Tracy. Hello. Yes.
Good evening. I am Dr. Tracy Jackson. I have my PhD in public policy and administration and a JD from the greatest university of the District of Columbia, David A. Clark School of Law. I am the alumni, or one of the alumni trustees. I also have worked at a university as adjunct professor. Currently, I'm with the District of Columbia DMV adjudication. So if you have any of those lovely tickets, you'll come down to the adjudications if you want to contest them. But I look forward to working on this committee and with the University Board of Trustees.
Wonderful. Thank you. Who else may I have missed? Anyone who's on the committee? I don't think so. No? Okay. Well, welcome to each of you. I can tell that this is a group that I don't have to give my old speech that when I was the president, I gave to trustees, and that was, it does not matter that you're not from higher ed. In fact, it's particularly important, because we need perspectives that come from outside of the academy on the academy and what happens. So I personally look forward to learning from each of you what wonderful backgrounds, and I am delighted you're interested in academic affairs. I'm new to chairing the committee, and welcome, and just a small word here. I have a real bias toward active committee engagement and look forward to hearing what you have to say. And I think the administration does too from conversations we've had. So please, this is not just a reporting venue, though we'll do that. I will ask, because there's so much to report on, that Dr. Massey and Dr. Littleberry kind of be punchy as you go through it, because I can tell this group's going to have questions to ask as well. And you've got so much to report on. My preliminary meetings with by phone with Dr. Massey and Dr. Littleberry made me feel that there's a real fresh wind blowing, and the winds that were blowing were already very good, but that we've reached a marvelous place of, say, outcomes, which was the effort that I was pretty exclusively, from a committee perspective, involved with before, is now being combined in a most constructive way with curricular planning and course development and various other things. So you'll hear about that, and there are a lot of questions to be asked, and I look forward to hearing your voices in the course of this meeting over what I think is going to be a wonderful year ahead. So with that said, are there any further comments? Dr. Eddington, did you want to say anything? And or shall we plunge?
I just want to just to welcome our new members to the committee. You know, I was just sitting here reflecting on what you said, is that this is a totally new committee, right? This is not, there's no one here, I think, who was on the committee before. And essentially the board is almost a completely different board. So there's a lot of energy, positive energy that we are seeing. And so we're excited. I'm excited. I personally look forward to working with each of you through this committee, as well as the full board. So welcome, everyone.
Super. Thank you. You have before you the agenda, which we apologize got to you a bit late. That will work not to have happened again. And that, I think we've already dealt with the so-called approval of minutes. I've never been a committee of one before. So we will have that statement issued that I, well, Dr. Eddington, you were probably there too. I don't know, but the essential minutes as written are essentially correct. So let's move right along and ask Dr. Massey to begin telling us our very meaty agenda here, please.
So I will try to condense pieces that don't need as much attention. And Dr. Barazzoni has asked that I pay most attention to my item 3, where there's a little more information about where we are now and where we're going futuristically. And so good afternoon. I'm April Massey. I'm the Chief Academic Officer for the university, and I'm pleased to be with you this evening. I'm comfortable with you jumping in with your questions as I move through the presentation, so please stop me at any point if there are questions that you have. So, Ms. Rivers, if you would start my slide presentation. There are lots of slides. We're not going to stop on every one, but the slideshow will then be presented to you. And if you have questions as a follow-up after today's meeting, I can make myself available at your convenience.
Great. Thank you.
I'm having a technical difficulty that I'm trying to resolve.
Oh.
So do you want me to go ahead and start talking?
Yes, please. Yes, yes, please. If you can.
So there are actually 3 bullet points on the agenda for me. And the first is really walking you through the state of academic affairs, where we are, how we ended academic year 24-25, and how it positions us for our next steps. So if you could take me to the second slide for Nika. Thank you so much. A little bit about who we are by mission. The Office of the Division of Academic Affairs really stands responsible for being a shepherd of all things academic for the institution, with primary focus on the quality of the curriculum and the quality and comprehensiveness and competitiveness of its delivery. And so Our responsibility is to ensure the relevance and integrity of the university's academic programs, provide leadership for and oversight for the university's academic workforce and research operations, shepherd partner, funder, and donor relationships in support of the university's programs, students, and faculty. We're responsible for cultivating the talent pipelines that support academic affairs, designing and implementing professional development opportunities that support our faculty and staff, and for fostering and sustaining mutually beneficial relationships with our community. Additionally, we have been working on an academic master plan, and so the strategic priorities for academic affairs that bridge 2025 to 2029 really focus on putting in place something that we've not had in a formal way, is a comprehensive academic master plan that really does serve as a blueprint for how we are identifying what our strengths currently are, how they scaffold the places that we can and should go, how we identify what are the quality markers of our successes in those areas, and how we build the infrastructure that will allow us to implement and sustain excellence and excellence at scale in those areas. In addition to where we are by mission and vision and strategic priorities, I think it's important to talk a little bit about the ways that we are signaling already to our internal and external stakeholders that we are meeting quality markers. Dr. Eddington spoke to a group today and talked about that we got formal acknowledgement of our endorsement by the Middle States Commission on Higher Education, and there are specific markers for our academic programs, and we met each of the benchmarks, and so we're very pleased about that. We're particularly pleased about the fact that we continue to get a positive reaction to the liberal arts core that we've built. We did a rebuild in 2010, revisited in 2015, and we've continued to tweak the ways that we are building a liberal education base that weaves through the four-year experience of our undergraduate students, building toward a capstone experience that weds them to the communities that they live and work in and allows them to work with peers across disciplinary lines as they will go into work and build toward a skill set that has been identified by employers as a necessary opportunity in the graduates that they are seeking for their employees. We have, in the academic affairs, the organization is six academic units in terms of colleges and schools. We also have a workforce development unit, and we have a division of learning resources where a library sits, and we have a division of a center for the advancement of learning, which is largely our teaching learning center, and it houses the work that we're doing in building an online presence. We offer more than 80 academic programs. We're 225 faculty members strong. We just added about 35 new faculty members this year. We have a few positions that remain vacant that we are actually actively working to fill. We also have a number of academic staff that support the academic enterprise, and we are well connected to our colleagues in student development and success to begin to bridge the work across the two parts of the house so that we create a seamless experience for students. I'll go to, I think it would be for you, Franika, the fifth slide. I think that's too far advanced. It should be academic affairs agenda continued, where I talk about 24-25 highlights. So I'll just keep talking. So we'll talk a little bit about where we are. We had a banner year in terms of graduation for 24-25. We graduated almost 800 students, with students represented across the four-year graduate and professional programs. We had, across the academic year, about 1,200 students recognized for honors that included Dean's List, top honors across the academic year, fall and spring semesters, and so we're very proud of that. We had a number of faculty members, better than 30, that moved through promotion and or tenure at the end of the spring term and are moving into new salary ranges and new academic ranks this fall, and so we're very pleased there. We were able to complete and have fully ratified a new faculty contract, the ninth master agreement, that has significant implications for the way that we structure work for our faculty members. It changed our workload formula. It changed our compensation structure. It changed our evaluation system, absolutely brand new. And it changed our workload, compensation, evaluation. And I'm blanking on, there were four. And I'm blanking on the fourth. I mean, I'm the chief negotiator now. I can't remember, but it will come to me. And so we have had promotion, evaluation, compensation, and workload. And so we made significant advances in doing two things, creating real relationship with our faculty colleagues as we negotiated at that table and we walked away as real partners in the work. But we also changed significantly the ways that we are approaching the work. We moved our faculty members from 4-4 teaching loads to 3-3, which is almost unheard of in a institution that is largely a teaching institution. And so we are making the space for our faculty members to show up in the work and have the space to really drill into the opportunities that they can provide for our students. So we're very proud of that. In a later slide, I have some data from Victor McCrary that talks about where we are with research enterprise. Can we go to the next slide, Franica? I wanted to highlight where we are with numbers fall 25 compared to fall 24. You will see that we have stabilized enrollment, and so might be described as flat. I'm describing it as stable and really pleased with the fact that we didn't lose any ground and that you can see that the programs where the numbers fluctuated, they fluctuated minimally. So we're really pleased with the way that the numbers are falling out. And you can see where our numbers break down in terms of undergraduate, graduate, and law. So next slide. I wanted to pay attention to where we have the highest enrollments at the undergrad and graduate levels. And one of the things that Dr. Barazzoni and I talked about and that I'm working with the deans on is really identifying where our programmatic strengths are, how those programmatic strengths align with data sets that we're receiving from the Office of the Deputy Mayor and in alignment with the DC Comeback Plan so that we are identifying where UDC has real resonance with economic drivers, the job sectors in the city, and jobs that align with middle-class incomes. And so you'll see on a later slide, the Office of the Deputy Mayor commissioned a group to do some work around looking at data sets that drill into which majors at UDC align with where the jobs are and the best paying jobs are. And what they found is that at our four-year level, about 80% of the majors that we offer align with the jobs that are available in the region and that pay good salaries. At the community college, it's about 50%. What the data sets show us, though, is that we have seats, at least from the metrics that the DME used, seats available for students, so we're not filling this to capacity and putting as many students in seats as we possibly could. And we also aren't necessarily taking advantage of major offerings that would also seamlessly align with where jobs are in the city and where the best salaries are. And so I will make available, I've already given it to Ms. Rivers to make available to Dr. Barazzoni, but I'll make it available to everybody on the committee, the ETEP report, because it's a really important one. On the graduate side, EAB in the acronym, the letters now escape me, but they have done the same thing for our graduate program. So we are able to see completely how what we offer aligns with where the jobs are. And so when we are advertising our programs to prospective students, we can tell them before they make a decision to come to us where they will be able to work, what their salary ranges will be, what jobs will allow them career advancement. We can tell them that in the marketing of the programs out to the public, and that's a really important opportunity for us. It's not data that we had before. It really is an absolute game changer for us. But you can see, and Ms. Bird makes these reports available to cabinet members weekly until we lock down for the fall census. But you can see where the numbers are not just high in terms of enrollments, but where they have been stable. It's important to look at things like aviation maintenance nearly doubled its number over last year, which looks like an amazingly a significant opportunity. except that we didn't double the size of our infrastructure for aviation maintenance, and so we created kind of a backlog. And so one of the things that we want to do is we want to be mindful of the ETEP data, but we also have to have comprehensive capacity studies that say to us where we have the ability to add numbers and where our numbers are basically set. And so I'll give you another example on the graduate side. If you look at speech pathology, the number over 24-25 basically stable because they have done the work of capacity study. That's a clinical science program at the graduate level where there are a number of clinical hours, I think it's 400, that their students have to amass across a two-year period. But we're competing with GW and other, Howard and other universities in the area for extern placements, hospitals, schools, clinics, and the students can choose to have an exit opportunity capstone-like that can include a thesis. And so depending upon the expectations of the engagement across the program, what we identify as capacity is going to change. And so for Speech Path, we identify that we can take as few as 18 students and make a class that's competitive and that is a good enrollment number for the institution, but we can't take more than 24 students and educate them in ways that give them a competitive edge at graduation. And that's a program where we are doing 100% placement before those students graduate. And not only are they graduating into jobs, but retention in the field at 5 years is nearly 100%. And then progression in career within the discipline is also nearly 100%. And those are the markers that we're looking at. So what you will find as we continue to talk about metrics, there's a lot of emphasis that we will be paying attention to in terms of enrollment. We're going to be looking at persistence. We're going to be looking at retention and graduation. But within that, we're going to be looking at some other markers. And if we can go to the next slide, I think it is Franika. I think that's the research slide. And so you can see there where we are in terms of total funding that was requested by PIs, where proposals were declined, where we got cancellations. But on the next slide, you can see that we had expenditures that eclipsed $9 million, which is fairly significant for an institution our size that is not identified as a research engine in terms of the focus of the institution. Can we go to the next slide, please? I think I'm skipping something that I wanted to show. Can you go to slide 11? I'm sorry. I did these slides myself, and so there's some issues with the order.
Good job.
Okay. So this is small, but Dr. Eddington had all of the cabinet members just on, I think it was Monday, Dr. Eddington, or last Friday, have us complete for this academic year an action plan. And one of the things that he asked us for, which we do today, is a set of metrics that we're going to be guided by in terms of the ways that we approach and move through the work. And so for academic affairs, and academic affairs is it now bridges very intentionally to the work of student affairs, of course we're going to be looking at the big three, big four, enrollment, persistence, retention, graduation. But within the academic experience, we also have to pay attention to some other drivers. And so metrics that we're going to be paying attention to are internal and external demand for our programs. And the external demand is going to tie us directly to the ETEP and the EAP data. We're going to be looking for near seamless alignment with those databases in terms of the ways that we infuse new dollars into the programs that exist and the ways that we approach the build of new programs. We're also going to be paying attention to whether or not our students have access to internships during their academic journeys and if those internships tie them directly to jobs at completion. And so we want to know that students not only get internships, but the data on high-skip practices, of which internships would be an important one, say that the reason that you want your students in internships because they are a number one point of access for jobs with those same agencies. And so we need to start tracking whether or not that bears true for our students. So that's a metric that we're going to start paying very close attention to. So job offers offered through internship connections, degree completion rates and time frame, graduate transitions to career, next levels of education, and then graduation success. So we're looking at pathways in career once our students leave us. And a hallmark of success in terms of how you've prepared your students is how they seamlessly either move within a career or across careers, but they meet with satisfaction at each level of engagement in a job, and they're able to either flexibly move into new opportunities within a company or other companies because the skill set is flexible enough, broad enough to give them the opportunity to move. And what employers are saying to us is that while we have very technical disciplines that we're preparing students for, they're less concerned about students' technical training, more concerned about the overarching liberal arts core, because they say we can train them on the technical skills. What we can't do is train them, prepare them in the academic readiness skills. And so we're trying to make sure that our general education core, woven through the four-year experience, continues to reinforce that our students have to be wholly educated, and that's a thing that we're paying attention to across our academic experiences. Can I see the next slide, Franika? And if I'm moving too quickly, just tell me, and you can stop me at any point. I don't want to cut into Dr. Littleberry's time, and I don't want Dr. Barazzoni to give me the hook. So on the second part, so we're looking at two things this year in terms of the Academic Affairs Action Plan. The first is very intentionally focused on our academic programs in three ways. Their alignment with the data sets that say where the jobs are, the quality of the interactions that are happening inside the classrooms, and one of the things that we're very, very concerned about is ensuring that from the day that students enter or even start to look at our programs, that they are able to see and experience by doing the work that they will do as graduates. So we want very experiential opportunities in our classrooms, and we want that from day one. So, Franika, I don't know what happened to the quality of that slide, but it's something happened, but it's okay. And then the second piece of our attention across this academic year is going to be on faculty supports, faculty satisfaction, faculty productivity. We have made two very significant hires across the prior academic year. The first was in December of 2024. We hired an associate CAO for faculty affairs. The university has never had an individual that was dedicated to supporting faculty success. And so Dr. Adna Johnson has hit the ground running. She has already built a faculty success infrastructure, and she has initiated a new faculty academy that already has 30 new faculty members signed up and actively engaged in the programming that she has begun to offer. The second hire is Dr. Maisha Carter. She is the inaugural associate CAO for the student experience, and she is, in person, the bridge to student development and success for ensuring that the classroom experience of the student is tied to the supports of the student affairs division, and that we are bridging what's happening for students. So it's not that they have a classroom experience and then a community experience through student development and success, but that their academic experience is a comprehensive experience that ties all of the resources and that we are doing so very intentionally for them. But you will see for faculty in terms of metrics that we're paying attention to, retention has been a big one for us. We've had a revolving door of faculty. We've been doing about 35 to 40 new hires of faculty annually because we've just been losing people at that rate, and that's not something that we can sustain. We don't have the manpower to do searches at that level annually, but we also disrupt the student experience when we keep moving faculty in and out of their programs. And so we're going to work very intentionally to create supports for faculty that want them to be here. And so the faculty contracts and the compensation packaging is one part of that, but there are other parts to having faculty satisfied on your campus that we're going to pay a lot more attention to. So retention, engagement, whether or not faculty members see the resources that we're making available to them as important for the things that they want to be able to do. How satisfied are they? What do they say about what it feels like to be on this campus, to work on this campus, and how does it compare to what they're hearing from their peers around the country, around the city? We're going to be looking at outputs, publications, grants, grant applications, awards, invitations to be experts in those fields around the country. But we're also going to be looking comprehensively at community-based research, which is a growing field. And we have a number of researchers on our campus who are doing very exciting work in a community-based way, community-based writing, community-based health measures. And so those things, we want to expand our definitions of what scholarship is. We're going to be looking at people coming up for promotion and tenure timely, using sabbatical as a tool that really does enhance the faculty ability to show up in classrooms optimally. And so all of those things are going to be paying attention to. Franika, can we go to, I think it's the slide above that one. But my own computer has frozen. So I wanted to just sample from the education to employment pathways a few of the signs. You can go back to the ETEP here. And so you see what the policy board of ETEP was intended to do. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see that they specifically wrote in some expectations for the University of the District of Columbia. Those are questions that they're answering. If you go to the next slide, Franika. So you see here that they were very specific in the ways that they wanted this data set to have impact on UDC understanding its value, UDC understanding how it can and should, must increase the way that it is showing up for residents of the city. And so I think these are very important slides. Next slide, please. Analysis on the ways that we are doing our program offerings and the alignments. I think that's really very, very important. Next slide, please. And so you see here that they make the distinction between where we are in terms of our undergraduate degrees at the 2 and 4 year levels. The EAB data will do the same for us at the graduate level, but these are going to be the guideposts that direct how we are going to be showing up programmatically on this campus. And we have 3 members of our community that are meeting with the DME committee monthly. I am, Maria Bird is, Maisha Carter is, and so we are entrenched in the work of the committee. We are helping to drive the way that this is shaping up. We are active participants in the ways that UDC is being tasked with participating in the city in terms of being a driver of employment opportunities for the residents of the city. Next slide, Franika. And so you see that this just in that, and then next slide, please. You can skip to the next, I'm sorry. So I wanted to kind of end on a note that wasn't so dense with a whole lot of stuff on the slide. We opened this academic year with opening professional development on August 18, and we're about 225 faculty members strong. We had 211 faculty members in the auditorium on that day, stayed for a full day. We launched the year with a focus on service excellence. HR came in and they did, there's a mandatory training that the institution has in place. And so we were able to tick the box for all faculty members in the auditorium that day. But we also talked about the ways that we want to show up in our classrooms, the importance of the new contract as a guidepost for the ways that we will work together. And then we had some opportunity just to do some case studies around the application of the new contract and support faculty members. Across that week, we had an opportunity to welcome new faculty at a luncheon. The president was there. And people were very pleased to join us. We had more than 35 faculty members in the suite here. And then we also had that week a reception for newly promoted and tenured faculty members, and we had about 40 people in the space, and we enjoyed a really nice reception. So we've been working very hard to create a space that feels like community, that makes people want to stay, that makes people unafraid to ask for help, to let us know what they need, to let us know when the help that we're offering isn't helping them, and really building some reciprocity around the ways that we move forward. And the last slide, I just wanted to bring to your attention that next Thursday, we will be celebrating opening convocation, and we will use it as an opportunity to kick off the celebration of 175 years of turning potential into power. We're using the opportunity of opening convocation to really celebrate the opening of the academic year and put on display the really good work that we're doing. We're going to do a prelude with some vignettes faculty work that aligns seamlessly with some transformative opportunities for students. We have a student pair that we're featuring, and then we're going to initiate a new practice. We're going to do a convocation lecturer, a faculty member who will use a small snippet of one of her lectures. She was nominated and was chosen based on the ways that she has shown up in her classrooms and used the city as an extension of her UDC spaces, and is positioning her students all around the city to be experts in any of a number of things. But she really has shown us new opportunities to envision what field work means across different disciplines. And so we're excited about that. And then we're going to give convocation awards for the first time this year. And so we have a scholarship for a student, and we have a cash opportunity for the faculty member who's the lecturer to actually support the things that she needs to do or has been doing with her students, and to kind of lessen the burden for them and her. So I'm going to stop there. I'm open for any questions that you may have, and I'll send the presentation forwards. Ms. Rivers has it, so she can share it with all of you. If you have questions later, I'll be available to support those.
That was terrific. Thank you so much. Would anyone like to make a comment, ask a question? Please, Tracy. You're muted. Yeah. She's still muted. Just a second. Franika's trying something here. Hang on, Dr. Jackson. We're getting there, we hope.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I was going to welcome you too. Apologies.
Yes, thank you. I actually been on the whole time. There was transferring from the other platform, so I've heard everything. Thank you.
Good. I trust everyone agrees after listening to this report or challenging set of issues that it's very exciting the way the work is coming together to do careful analysis and come up with plans that address real questions that we know are our questions. Michael Dannenberg, please go ahead while we're working on our muted colleague here.
Sure. A couple things. First of all, thank you, Dr. Massey. And I'm really looking forward to looking at the slides more in depth. I guess in the future, I asked with respect to this committee, if there are slide presentations such as this, if we could get them beforehand so that we could have time to reflect on them and then maybe offer better questions and comments. There were three things that kind of jumped out at me from this presentation. The first is that it looked like Associate of Arts degree enrollment in education is down 20%, and I'm wondering why that is. The second is Dr. Massey mentioned, or why you think that is, and if it's a good thing or a bad thing. The second is, I believe Dr. Massey said that 50% of community college programs align with high-wage jobs, but that's a percentage of programs and not a percentage of enrollment. And so I'm wondering what percentage of students are in programs that align with in-demand jobs. And then the third is a sort of general question, which is, frankly, it's not clear to me, and I've tried to find out the answer to this, what the UDC completion rate is within 6 years of initial enrollment of students at both the four-year institution and at the community college. And as a related question, what is it that Academic Affairs is doing to improve upon that completion rate? Lots of folks are talking about boosting completion rates by providing wraparound services, but I hear very little nationally about what folks are doing in terms of the academic program in order to improve completion rates. So those are my quick thoughts and questions.
Can I start with your last question first?
Please.
Okay. So one of the opportunities of Dr. Carter's hire is to look at the stickiness of the classroom as an opportunity to keep students in seats. And so when we look at opportunities around the country and where the data sets show us that for many students is the opportunity that they experience within the first 30 days of their enrollment in the classroom. So it's not the other services, it's what they experience at the hands of the faculty members in those classrooms that make them decide to stay or go. And so we want to look very intentionally at the ways that our faculty members are supported in showing up in classrooms to give students an opportunity to get a feel within that first 30 days that this is a place where I can become the person that I'm seeking to be through this degree experience. And so those are the things in terms of academic affairs. We are very, very focused on what we are doing and how it is resonating or not with the students that have decided to come to us and give us a try. And so when we've talked to students and done surveys of students who have decided to leave within the first semester, often we get from students a response, something like, it wasn't what I thought it would be. I wanted more rigor. I didn't feel like I had a peer group. I was looking to have more problem-based learning. I was looking to have more hands-on learning, and those were not things that I experienced in my first semester.
That's great for students who are transitioning as for initial enrollment. What about for students who are having trouble completing, who have already put in a significant amount of investment in terms of credits earned? Are there is there early access to academic pathways to ensure that they get courses that they need in order to complete on time, for example?
So one of the things that we've been doing is sweeping records of students to see where the credits are, what's missing, where there is excess to try to minimize that. And so the transition work that we've been doing in the community college has been doing a really good job, but Dr. Littleberry's new advising model will also address this, is to make available to students so that they know even before they have signed the dotted line, say that they are coming to UBC, that they can see a pathway to completion that allows them to know by semester where the courses are going to be, how they're going to move forward, and a reasonable prediction of what the time to completion will be based on the degree maps. And so while we have transitioned advising to a professional advising model, the responsibility for clean, comprehensive degree maps rests with the faculty members.
That's great. And what about that earlier question I asked about the percentage of programs versus the percentage of students that are in programs that are aligned with high wage jobs?
So the data is in the report. I don't, off the top of my head, I can't give you that answer, but I can move through the report and reference it, and I can get back, and you'll be able to see it for yourself as well.
So maybe this is a question for President Eddington rather than you, Dr. Massey. Is there an effort to try and channel students or increase the availability, shall I say abundance, of programs that are connected to high-wage occupations as opposed to low-wage occupations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the primary reasons behind the work that Dr. Massey is mentioning, right? So education through employment is looking at, hey, let's do an assessment of UDC's programs and how they align with the market. But the purpose is to have better alignment, right? Like, we don't need to have a lot of students in programs and pathways that don't lead to living wage jobs and that don't align with market need, right? And so we embraced that opportunity to be a part of that so that we could get our hands on that, what I call postgraduate, right? Data and outcomes. And so what Dr. Massey is doing is working with her team now to say, okay, how do we better align our curriculum and programs, high demand, and what should we do about opportunities where we've seen low alignment, right? But that work is just starting, right? Like, we just got the data a few months back, and she and her team are now working with the ETEP team. But that's the goal. That's what we're trying to do. And I did want to say something about your part of your question about the data, the rate, graduation rate data, retention data. So we have an actual report that we develop called a Performance Outcomes Accountability Report. It's something that I brought from my prior institution, right, in terms of looking at how Florida and a performance-based funding model works in that system. So we came and we said, hey, let's adopt the same type of approach and methodology around identifying key student outcome metrics. And you'll have the report because you're going to be heavily involved in this work moving forward. But in the report, you'll see we map out all of these metrics for the different populations of students, looking at 3-year graduation rates for associates, students, full-time, part-time, 4-year and 6-year graduation rates for bachelor's students, full-time, part-time. Right? There's several metrics. So we mapped all that out, and we've got the historical trends mapped out. And so now what we're doing, right, and the board approved it a few months back, right, the first iteration. And so we're going to bring back in November the updated version, but the way we use that report, and you'll see we set target goals, incremental goals each year around each metric. And that's how we monitor our progress on moving the needle. And then we have to, as you know, challenge ourselves and make sure that we have the right strategies, resources aligned. But we're very data and metric focused in the work we're doing that you'll see.
That's great. Thank you. And for what it's worth, I know I can tell you in Massachusetts, what we're seeing in the data is that when it comes to students who are completing degree programs, never mind those who don't complete, which is worse. Students who are completing associate degree programs in liberal arts, frankly, have the lowest level of earnings. Associated with in terms of their outcomes. And in fact, students who are completing in STEM at the associate's level have earning outcomes that are higher than students with a bachelor's degree in some arts and sciences. So I caught that number of 250-odd enrolled students in liberal studies in the associate's program and thought, huh, I wonder what kind of earnings outcomes these folks are going to have to the extent they do complete, and whether or not we want to be pushing the pedal on those programs as opposed to other programs where there might be a higher likelihood of success. Well, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt and filibuster.
That was not an interruption. That's the core of what we do. Thank you very much. Is Tracy on? Okay.
Yes.
That is terrific. Great. We hear your voice. Please go ahead.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'll have a series of questions, but I will stop and just ask a few. I wanted to know if there is an update on the paralegal studies. I know that it was initially due to be launched. Is there an update on that program?
So the program was fully approved and moved through Department of Ed, so it's been approved for financial aid receipt, and so the program is on the book for this semester.
Is there any current enrollment, students that are enrolled for the program?
It might have been one of the programs that didn't make this list, but I have to look at the full list to see what the enrollment would be.
Okay. And then early in your presentation, you defined certain things. I just want to get a little bit more information because you talked about a good salary. What exactly is defined as a good salary, particularly for DC?
So the report actually defines what a middle-class wage is, and I think it's $65,000 for a family of four. I think, but the report defines that based on data for the city. That's not defined by us. It's defined in the
report. I just wanted to know what we were using. Okay. And for the job placement, I was wondering, do we have tracking data and trends available?
So we do have for some of the disciplines, not all, but we just made a hire of a new career services director, and that work will be initiated. So for some of the programs, we absolutely have that. Comprehensively, we do not.
Okay. And then is that going to be the ones that you have in the report that can be made available for to us to review?
That's not attached to the ETEP data. I can provide you with information around some of the disciplines where we have those. So for anything that's accredited, those are mandatory reporting variables. So that we would have that for any of the accredited programs, but not for every program.
Okay. How closely does the faculty resemble the student population?
And so I guess it depends on what variable we're looking at. If we're looking at across gender, we are female heavy on the student side. Our balance for faculty is probably more female than male, but I can't tell you exactly what the number is. By language, we are less representative in terms of language variety on the faculty side than we are on the student side. In terms of geographic origin, we have less diversity on the faculty side than we do on the student side. And so it's clearly not a one-to-one alignment, no.
Okay. I was also curious, you talked about some faculty turnover, but I was wondering, was there any data for reasons for the faculty turnover?
Mm-hmm. So we actually try to do exit interviews with faculty members that make decisions to leave us. And so compensation has been a big one, but not just salary. It's been compensation inclusive of startup packaging. It's been workload. It's been lab space. So it's been a comprehensive approach to compensation that the university is now working through.
And I was just curious what was the percentage, if any, for any tenure applications that were not accepted for a tenure or a promotion?
So in the last 2 years of cycle, it would have been less than 10% in either year.
Okay. Yep. Thank you so much. And I do agree with if we have any presentations, if we can get them beforehand, then that would greatly be appreciated. But thank you so much.
Are there any other comments or questions? Those were terrific. Thank you very much. All right. Then are we ready to move to Dr. Littleberry? Or are you doing okay with where we are? All right. Let's ask Dr. Littleberry now to move to her portion of the agenda, please. Is she on?
Good afternoon, trustees.
There you are. Hello.
Fernika has my presentation, so thank you, Fernika. As indicated, I am Terry Littleberry, and I have the privilege of serving as the Chief Student Development and Success Officer here at the university. And for those who are most familiar with higher education, that simply means that I am the Senior Student Affairs Officer here at the university. And Fernika, we'll move to the next slide, please. I'm pleased to introduce you tonight, trustees, to the Division of Students Development and Success, affectionately known on campus as SDNS. Here on this slide, you'll see our mission statement, and I certainly wouldn't insult you by reading the statement to you, but I would just like to highlight the fact that our mission is to is student development through support through exceptional support services, innovative programming, and inclusive engagement. Of course, ultimately, like any other institution in the country, our goal is to help our students transform into confident, well-rounded leaders prepared to make meaningful contributions to society. SDNS is comprised of the four subdivisions listed here on the slide: enrollment management, student success, student development, and athletics. This simply means that we take care of almost everything concerning a student outside of the classroom. And with that, Fernika, we'll move to the next slide. I'll go more in depth. I felt it was important, given that we have so many new trustees tonight, to introduce you to other persons on the team who actually helped me in the work that we have to do, lead this work out. And so in our enrollment management division, we have Dr. Hassan Atias, who serves as the VP for enrollment management, Dr. Joseph Green, who serves as the AVP for student success, Mr. Chio Shepherd, who serves as the AVP for student development, and Ms. Patricia Thomas, who is our athletic director. Next slide for Nika. Thank you. I arrived at the University of the District of Columbia in November of 2023, and over the last year and a half, my priorities have been focused on establishing a student success framework, building a team that aligns with the university's strategic priorities, fostering a sense of belonging with our students through the expansion of programming in our Office of Student Life and other offices as well, and enhancing opportunities for our staff to engage in professional development, both on and off campus. And in the next few slides, I'll talk more about each of these priorities. There are four main tenets. There were four main tenets that needed to be addressed in the establishment of our student success framework. The first being identifying and launching a comprehensive student success center. Our previous space was housed, we housed multiple units, but there was no clear delineation between the units in the space in which we were housed. And it could be somewhat confusing to our students what services were offered in that space. And I'm pleased to report to you tonight that in collaboration with the Office of the Chief Operating Officer and his team, we were able to identify a new location for our Student Success Center, which is now located at 4225 Connecticut Avenue. And if you're familiar with the campus, this building previously housed a Walgreens right across from the main campus. As our Student Success Center, the space now houses the Center for Academic Advising, the Career Services Center, the Office of Academic Excellence and Retention, and the Office of the Chief, which is my office, and a Tutorial Center. We officially began receiving students in this new location as of August 25th, so we are exactly about 3 weeks into this space. We're still doing a little cleanup, living out of boxes and unpacking boxes as the work finishes, but it was important to make sure that we had this space available for our students at the start of the academic year, so we would not have to have an interruption in shutting down and moving prior during the midst of the fall term. Our new strategic plan lays out, next slide for Nika, please. Our new strategic plan, I'm sorry, back up. I went too fast. Our new strategic plan lays out a bold vision for enrollment growth over the next 5 years. To achieve the goal of 6,000 students, it was imperative that we strategically develop a plan for achieving the goal. We sought to create a strategic enrollment plan developed in collaboration with partners from throughout the university. The plan is a roadmap identifying needed actions that will lead ultimately to increased enrollment. Implementation began at the start of 2025. The team continues to meet on a biweekly basis to ensure that we remain committed to achieving each milestone within the plan. Data told us that a significant number of our students were graduating with excess credit hours, and in many cases, academic advising was one of those reasons. Previously, we used a 2+2 advising model. The first and second year students were advised by professional advisors, and junior and senior students were advised by faculty advisors. Many students were lost in the transition between sophomore and junior year. Changing to a professional advising model creates greater opportunity for tracking our students and being proactive in our approach to working with and helping our students. It also ensures that students are not lost in the transition and they are able to build relationships with their academic advisor throughout their time with us. We've also implemented a new academic advisement model. In partnership With EAB, we determined that the differentiated care model was the best model for UDC. Students are helped in the model based on their performance, and it allows us to engage students more or less based on their needs. EAB spent time on our campus training our staff on the model. We had two visits with EAB, one where they just trained SDNS staff, and then a second time where they came back and trained additional SDNS staff along with faculty and other staff members from the Division of Academic Affairs before we launched the model beginning fall 2025. So this, we partnered with EAB. They came in over the summer of 2025. They met with our team. They trained, and then we launched officially the model this term.
Dr. Logan, one key additional fact to mention, you may have been planning to say later, but as part of this framework that she's describing early in her tenure, she assessed the infrastructure and staffing in, under academic support services, and we identified a need for additional advisors. And so we built into our budget request to the district that year a request for additional funds to support the student success framework. And we received $1.1 million. And this starts with the current year, FY25. And so we used those dollars to establish 10 new academic advisor positions, which C is using to do the work. You know, and we had some pre-existing position, but those additional roles are going to be what she uses to put this framework in place. And so I wanted you all to see that there was a connection between the strategy and best practices with our budget and planning process, right? Because we need additional resources to support the work.
Yes, you jumped ahead of slide. Wait,
I'm sorry. I thought you might be planning to say that.
Organizational infrastructure is where we are on this slide. To ensure that the appropriate focus was given to student success overall, we launched the search for an associate vice president for student success in the spring of 2024. And this hire was critical to ensuring the proper time and attention could be given not only to our student success planning, but implementation and execution over the long term. It resulted, as a result of that launch, we realigned some departments within the division. And these departments include academic advising, academic excellence and retention, the Office of Career Services, First Year Experience and Orientation, and our federally funded TRIO programs.
Next slide for Nika. Thank you. As I mentioned previously, several strategic hires were made over the last year and a half. The first addition to our team was Mr. Percy Henry, our Director of Student Life. Mr. Henry joined our team during the spring 2024 term. He is leading the transformation of our Student Life program, and he and his team have reimagined our student engagement and the creation of student belonging through their diverse program offerings, the student leadership experiences that we offer. So a part of our priority based on the strategic plan was to increase and foster a sense of belonging with our students. The fastest way for us to do that initially was to engage them in student life. When I arrived on campus, we had very low turnout for many of our student life events. They might show up, they might not show up. Even when it came down to students who wanted to be involved in some of our student leadership positions, on average, we would have about maybe 20 applications for all the positions across the board.
We are now seeing this year, in just a little over a year of Mr. Henry being here, we had more than 100 applications for student leadership positions when elections were held. We have several hundred, at least a couple hundred students who show up for the various activities that are being hosted by Student Life, which makes all the difference in our being able to engage them in various ways. And not all of the programming, of course, that is offered through this office is fun and games. Sometimes it's leadership opportunities, bringing in various speakers or other others to help our students in various ways with their growth and development as students.
Following the hire of Mr. Henry, we moved into launching, as I mentioned before, the search for the AVP of Student Success, which is now filled by Dr. Joseph Green. Dr. Green has more than 20 years of experience in higher ed, including lots of experience in the area of student success. He brings a wealth of knowledge to his role from his former institutions, which include Virginia Union University, North Carolina Central, the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and Marquette University. Dr. Green is directly responsible for leading out our student success initiatives for the division and serves as the divisional liaison with academic affairs. So you heard Dr. Massey talk about the work that we will partner together to do. And just as she hired Dr. Myesha Carter, it was important to make sure that student affairs or student success and development was given the same attention to the work that needed to be done from our perspective, and create an seamless work where we work together to make sure that what students experience is seamless. And when we need to provide levels of support, we can do that both from student success and through academic affairs. We followed up the hiring of Dr. Green with Dr. Nicole Roberts-Jones, who joined our team this past summer. Dr. Jones leads out our career center. She is a certified career development coach, a best-selling author. Dr. Jones has a robust background in the entertainment industry and also worked with Northeastern University and MIT, McDonald's, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and several other organizations in the area of career development. And then we finally, in terms of leadership, rounded out our team with Mr. Chio Shepherd, who joined the team just last month in August as the AVP of Student Development and the Dean of Students. Mr. Shepherd, again, brings more than two decades of experience in his role from universities such as Westchester University, University of North Carolina, Texas Southern, and the University of St. Thomas. And then finally, as the president mentioned, the hiring of the 10 academic advisors. And I won't go through that again, but we did, as he indicated, receive enhancement dollars from the district to help us in hiring additional professional advisors, which brings our total number of academic advisors to 19 in our professional advising corps. Next slide, please, Renika. Sure. Fostering belonging through student life. I mentioned that we hired Mr. Henry, and once we hired him to help get this work done, we also brought on board Mr. Devontae Parker, who has experience at North Carolina A&T and Catholic University. He is serving in the role as the associate director, bringing our student life team to a total of 3 persons. We've made significant investments in our students by expanding their ability to attend student conferences, including the Student Leadership Conference, which now is an annual conference that we will host here on our campus through the Office of Student Life. And throughout the year, we offer other developmental opportunities, as I previously stated, including etiquette lunches and other things that we bring in community partners to help us with. We also follow this by expanding our program offerings and increasing, in some cases, and building updating in some cases and building in others our student life policies and protocols to make sure that we can manage what is happening with our students in clubs and organizations. And then finally, aside from ensuring that our student, we also work to make sure our student leaders are doing everything that they can, and we're doing what we can to bring the information that they learn at conferences back to other student groups. We, of course, everybody can't go to the same conference, but making sure that those conferences that they go to, they have an opportunity to come back, meet with other student leaders, and teach them what they have learned at those conferences so that we can increase the students that we in the touch of all of our students in terms of their leadership, growth, and development. Next slide, Franika. While we're making investments in our students, it's also important that we make investments in our staff. And many of our staff members, we have been able to work through various means to help them attend conferences and other professional development opportunities, both on and off campus. Opportunities for professional development continue to be a priority for us to ensure that they are able to learn about industry best practices and bring those practices back to the university as the work that we're doing now has to change or is changing. We want to make sure that they are aware of what industry best practices are and give them an opportunity to make those connections across other institutions so that they are able to better aid and help our students. So what you see on the screen are some of the conferences that they were able to attend this past year, and we look forward to being able to do the same thing over the over this coming year.
Next slide, please. Moving forward, so moving forward with this current academic year, our strategic priorities will focus on enrollment growth, student support, and student success initiatives. With enrollment, we will move into phase two of our Salesforce CRM implementation and the strategic phase two of our strategic enrollment management plan. We want to also continue to enhance our marketing and enrollment tools. Our student support focus will focus on expanding our services and how we can better engage our students, with emphasis on increasing both the availability and the use of support services by our students. It doesn't matter if we have the services available if students aren't using them. And so we, through task force work over the summer, have been working on developing plans that will help us be more proactive versus reactive or transactional in our engagement with students, but going out to the students versus waiting on them to come to us. And our student success initiatives will focus on partnering with academic affairs to enhance our co-curricular programming. So we're, again, working hand in hand with our academic teammates. Securing additional internship and employment opportunities for our students will also be one of the main focal points of our Career Services Center and staff in partnership with our workforce and innovation team members.
Next slide from Monika. So fall 2025, I'm pleased to report on our fall 2025 enrollment. After all the plans have been completed and the work has been done, it simply comes down to two questions. Did we retain our students and did we increase enrollment? And the answer to both of these questions is yes. Our fall enrollment stands at 4,153 students, which equates to a 1.2% increase above fall 2024. This year, a total of 1,305 students, new students, first time in college and transfer students enrolled. And of our total enrollment, 2,915 of those students are district residents. We have about 180 beds available for our university housing. And of that, at this moment, 148 of our students are currently in university-sponsored housing. We do have a wait list for housing, and we will now begin to pull students off of that wait list to fill the rest of our housing beds. We welcomed our new and returning students with a week-long celebration with the theme of a Firebird Rodeo. Next slide, Franika. Our Welcome Week activities began on August 17th and ended on Friday, August 29th. Students participated in our version of an urban trail ride. Our SGA and student ambassadors were sworn into office. We hosted various types of programs and activities for our students to include ice cream socials, vision board parties. We held our freshman pinning ceremony. Our career center also held two events called Suit Up for Success, and many other activities were offered for our students to give them a warm welcome to UDC. This concludes my report, trustees, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you so much for that. I'm going to take, Mr. Chair, did you want to ask a question? You got to go first.
No, go right ahead. Thank you.
Okay. All right. And my question is this. Faculty members must be dancing on the rooftops to have their teaching load go down from 8 to 6. And that's quite an achievement. And you also mentioned, this is a question for both of you, there was also mention of a new evaluation system. Then we're talking about hiring more professional advisors, which are very important, but my question is, in my opinion, they do not substitute for faculty. They play a different role, but this is me coming from my own perspective. I wonder if the new evaluation system and the reduction of faculty load combine in some way to not make optional any longer whether the faculty do things like midterm evaluations for students.
I'm sorry, I'll take it. No, those things are still required.
They're still required, but they weren't being done,
uniformly,
from what I believe I heard at an earlier board meeting. Thank you.
We have had for some time a mandatory midterm grade reporting. And so there are, and Dr. Littleberry and I just had this conversation earlier today. So as we're looking at the new advising model and systems for early alerts and population health, I think it was a term that you used, Dr. Littleberry.
Mm-hmm.
We were asking the question about, so we have these mandatory touch points that have to be reported, attendance verification, midterm grade, final grade. So every faculty member has a responsibility. It's a mandate that those things are reported every semester.
What am I misremembering then? Because I was pretty sure at a meeting not so long ago we were talking about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you're remembering the discussion around faculty using the early alert system, and we had, I forgot what the percentage was, it was a relatively low percentage of usage, and so we said we want to get, you know, ultimately, ideally 100%, right, but I think that's what you're remembering, is that we're going to work to get the faculty to use the tool that
right.
will allow the other units to become more aware in real time of students
yeah.
who are having issues yet.
Yes, and it seemed like such a worthy goal to me that I hoped that this new evaluation system would include some incentives to do that. You can mandate it, but if you can't enforce it, it doesn't matter much. So I'm just wondering what you're going to do are there any changes in faculty expectations with this decrease of load, which is a wonderful thing? I think you've reached a more standard amount of load for faculty this way, and you can hope to see lots of improvement, especially in the faculty who want to do research as well as teaching, and their ability to do good things for the students and the university and themselves. But sometime I think this, I would like to understand better what has changed in the evaluation system, and this may well not be the time to go into it. But one, I think it's great to just flag questions, and I would invite other members of the committee to do that as well, if you'd like.
Yeah, and I just, because I hear you, some of the things embedded in the question, and this is from my perspective. I think one of the things that can happen once you provide faculty with more time, you can mm-hmm. then begin to more reasonably expect them to do the things that they've been trying to do under the increased load, right? So you know, you want faculty to engage and mentor students and advise students. You want them to use the tools and resources and all these other things. But faculty will tell you, you know, I'm doing the best I can, but you know, there's only so many hours in a day. And I'm teaching four courses. And so now you pull back one of those courses in a given semester. And what the typical faculty member will say is, now I have more quality time to do the core things that I've been stressed thin around, right? And then to your specific examples, you will probably naturally see an increase in the usage of the early alert system, right? But then I think the other side of your question I'm hearing is, hey, you know, so what are we linking to performance evaluations at the same time, right? You know, so I think Dr. Massey and the team have some time to really kind of explain and describe those things moving forward, yeah.
And while the reduction is exciting on an individual basis, and I think important for institutional overall quality eventually, I do wonder the budgetary impact. Do we have to hire more faculty with this reduction in course load? And will it result in more adjuncts? What are the consequences of that change in faculty load?
So, you know, one of the things that we paid close attention to on the front side of this is really looking to see where we are, where we'd seek capacity. And so when we looked across the colleges and schools, the community college and the College of Arts and Sciences lead with maxing seat capacity, and they're both over 60%. But we have other academic units that are not eclipsing 20% in terms of seat capacity met. And so we have lots of opportunity to fill vacant seats really re-engineer the ways that we are approaching workload assignments. We also have the opportunity to look at cohort modeling, and we've been talking about this for years, but we've never really just bitten the bullet and really committed to identifying ways. And there are lots of models that show, even on a largely commuter campus, even with a large number of part-time students, there are still ways that you can create cohort modeling for students that moves them seamlessly as groups, so you know what courses are needed, you know how they're coming, and you know how to fill those seats. When we address those things with intentionality, we can tamp down the numbers of adjuncts that we need. It's not unrelated to this reduction of course load for faculty members, but the reduction in course load really wasn't driving the ways that we were overextended on the adjunct budget. Those were missed opportunities to really belt tighten around those two factors.
Yeah. It could lead perhaps to curriculum revision too, but enough. Other questions? Michael, I can't see that you have your hand up. I'm sorry. Please, go ahead.
That's okay. Thank you for going first and honing in on the 3x3 accomplishment, which I think is really huge.
Yeah.
That said, one of the things that excited me most in the last board meeting and in tonight's presentation is the reference to the hiring of at least 10 new advisors. And I think I heard you, Dr. Littleberry, reference that brings us to a total of 18 or so advisors, which is pretty good. My understanding is from the research, MDRC and others, that the best practices when it comes to student advising, is that it's not simply a reactive endeavor, but it is proactive, that there's a case management approach, that caseloads are kept to a maximum of 150 students to one, that there's a tracking of interactions, that there are monthly interactions at a minimum. And I'm wondering if any of these best practices or all of these best practices are implemented, and regardless of whether they are or are not, I believe your presentation referenced creating a culture of accountability mm-hmm. with respect to the operations of the Office on Student Success, and I'm wondering how is that operationalized. Okay. Those are my two both general and specific questions.
Sure. Thank you.
Sorry. May I just add to that, because those are very similar to the questions that I had. Is there any referral mechanism system as well that faculty can use to ensure that the proper students are identified or additional supports as needed? So anyways, that's just an additional component to the questions that you raised, Michael.
Sure. And while we're adding on, the specific identification of the best practices in the industry and how are you actually tracking and implementing and doing any, getting any trending from that as well.
This is going to be a good committee.
Mm-hmm. Please, go ahead, Teresa.
Thank you for your questions. And if I forget any part, I try to take notes, but if I forget anything, please remind me. So to start, Trustee Denenberg, the academic advisement model, the differentiated care model that we have implemented, basically will segment students into three populations. And the populations will be high touch, medium touch, low touch, right? So if we have a student who comes in who's super on, you know, Michael Denenberg comes in, he's straight A student, he knows what he wants, doesn't require too much interaction, right? Would probably get annoyed with a bunch of interaction and emails, then we're able to, we're working now to create our communication plans, but we are able to put those plans on a Tickler system and build out a communication plan that will send you communication, reach out to you, and do things and then nudge you in various ways to make sure that we're keeping in touch. And if you don't follow up, then an advisor will maybe move from emailing you to placing a call to you, inviting you to come in. Various things that we can do to just make sure that you're doing well. If life suddenly happens, well, let me say, then the medium touch might be somebody who is kind of that middle of the road student, and sometimes there are times when they need interaction, and other times things are fine. They hit a bump in the road, it doesn't derail them, but things are happening, and so you see some ebbs and flows with those students. Those students will get more interaction, more outreach from the department. And then the students who come in that we recognize from the very beginning, this student is going to need more interaction with their academic advisors, then those students will receive more communication from academic advising. Could be a series of phone calls, text messages, emails, what have you, trying to maintain and stay in touch with them, perhaps inviting them to a workshop, you know, various workshops that are happening around campus or being hosted, whether it's through academic advising, our academic coaching unit, the career services unit. So there are, as these plans are being built out, we're thinking about all the different ways that we can communicate and interact and engage our students without, you know, today's student, you can push them away if you have too much communication. So finding what the sweet spot is and making sure that we're doing just enough to keep them engaged versus pushing them away because they don't, you know, we're reaching out too much. So that the differentiated care model also allows that if a student is really a low-touch student, they don't need a lot of interaction, but then life suddenly happens to them, we start receiving early alerts. So yes, in our Navigate system, there is opportunity for faculty to raise alerts for students. The alerts could be good or bad, right? So if a student maybe fall 2025, spring 2025, they told us that the student was struggling with attendance, had low test scores, what have you, advisors and other team members from Student Success reached out to that student. We were able to help that student course correct and get back on track. But then by midterm, you can see that the student is in the system with this new model. So every academic advisor is able to see the population health of their students. So if there's they can see the percentage of students that they advise and where they fall in those three categories, high touch, low touch, or mid range, right? And if students are fluctuating, there's a specific, we're able to see which students are fluctuating in the model and adjust in real time to what that student needs, whether they need, you know, if they move from mid-range to high touch or what have you, we're able to adjust that real time in the model.
Great. Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to comment or question or observe?
So just to go back to identifying the industry best practices, how it's implemented and actually tracked, I heard like generality of mm-hmm. that, but I didn't hear specifics. And so I know you talked about how that between the high touch, medium, and low, but what specifically differentiates the two and what are the triggers for that? And if you can also discuss what supports or discuss any supports for mental health or accommodations that students may have, I have not heard anything of that nature, and how are we addressing those needs?
Sure. So, thank you. When alerts come in for students, right, so we may have a situation where faculty, and in most cases it will be faculty, that are sending alerts to us based on classroom performance. But we also there will also be an opportunity as other departments reach out. So they may not all be going into Navigate specifically to raise an alert, but when they reach out to, let's say, an advisor, they look in the system, they see who the student's advisor is, and they reach out to that advisor, and they indicate that there's an issue, the advisor then can notate in the system and flag this student that there's something happening with this student, which helps them to engage the student and hopefully get them to come in, right? There's a portion, we're going to do as much as we can, but then getting the student into the office is the key to being able to meet or by Zoom. So we're flexible in how we meet with students, whether it's online, whether it's in person, by phone. We don't talk we may not engage as much by phone just because needing to make sure we're actually talking to the student. But engaging with the student, once we have the opportunity to do that, the advisor can then help determine what is needed, right? So we do have the Office of Access
Accessibility Resource Center, which is the center where our students who need accommodations, students with various disabilities or learning exceptionalities, where they go to request service, we can get a student there. If there is maybe an accommodation that is needed that the student hasn't asked for. If there's counseling that is needed, our counseling center is certainly staffed and available to be able to help students and work with students. Sometimes it's medically related. Maybe a student is without a prescription or something that they need, and depending on the student, we may be able to service them through our health center. As it relates to best practices, part of this is we're going to track student retention, student success, best practices. The team, now that Dr. Carter is on board, she and Dr. Green, as well as some other staff, will be going to some conferences, learning more about student success, best practices, what's current in the industry. We do webinars through EAB, and we use our strategic advisory services through EAB to help keep us engaged in terms of retention, models for coaching, models for academic advising, and I'm certain that there will be other areas where we will bring those things back. Like I mentioned to you, we have task force that we established last spring to help us with our strategic priorities. And part of that is getting that information and then using that information in terms of helping us to build our internal metrics so that we're able to track and move towards achieving our goals via the accountability plan that the president mentioned earlier.
Oh, and I just wanted to add something around best practices. And appreciate the question. And so one of the things we did as we were developing the 5-year strategic plan and that accountability report I referenced earlier, we identified the suite of best practices, right, from literature, from experience. They're baked into the student success framework. So we could literally send you right now a list. And maybe we can. We have the specific strategies identified, and so what this student success team is doing, they're working to implement those strategies, right? So the way we got to the advising model that Dr. Littleberry talked about, right, was through this work, right? We didn't just say, hey, let's just throw something at the wall, right? It was through the evidence based assessments. And then appreciated, Trustee Denver, what you said earlier about the ratio, right, student advisor ratio. And so go back to saying we sent a request into the district for additional resources. We asked for $4 million, right? We got $1.1, but the reason it was $4 million is our proposal was to get UDC student advisor ratio to the level that you talked about, right, from literature and best practices. And we said, hey, we looked at our student population, our student body. We cited the research. We said, we need this student advisor ratio. We costed it out. We said, this is what we need. And then we got back some, So my point is to say, we've done all of that work, right? We're in implementation phase now, right? Like, so we're the team is working on those strategies, those best practices. And again, you'll hear me say this a lot. A lot of what we know is from prior experience too, right? We didn't just rely on the literature. We relied also on work that we've done to move the needle. And it was about adapting it to the UDC environment, right? So we will continue to drive those strategies. So I wanted to make sure you all understand that that's what the first 2 years was about, right? It's the building the foundation, identifying the strategies, and putting the team together. And you all are coming in at the perfect time, like from my perspective as a president. Right? I'm just sitting here loving this conversation because I'm seeing, and Dr. Berzoni and I talked about this, you're seeing the merging of a set of committee members with background expertise and keen interests in a topic that's the administration's top priority. And the administration now has the right people in the right positions in the strategy. And now y'all are going to work you know, and together is what we're saying. So it's just exciting. I just want to make sure y'all know that I'm very excited about the work y'all are going to do with our team, the board, and these leaders here.
I do want to add specifically, because if we are aware and can track and can monitor, because I know as well as the Board of Trustees, DC Council likes data. And so if we can see the specific metrics that you're looking at, the best practices that you're actually tracking, then we too can help or to take a look at and follow those things. I want to ask a couple more questions. One is, have we also accounted for, or are there any differentiation according to different types of students? For example, if you have non-traditional older students, what would those strategies look like, and have they been discussed, and how that may look a little bit different? You know, if there's something completely different if you're dealing with a baby boomer compared to a Gen X, compared to a millennial on down, and what does that actually look like? And also, early in the presentation, you discussed trying to achieve an enrollment, I believe, of 6,000 students, and if you can elaborate on the action items or the steps to be able to reach that, or, you know, just discuss that a little bit more, I'd greatly appreciate it.
At this point, I want to just jump in and say this. Those are fabulous questions, and I certainly want the staff to have a chance to take a short crack at them if they want to, but I'd like to ask also another question. I want to honor an 8 o'clock stop on this committee, which we had promised you. So can we have, I think these are such important questions, they may well call for a dedicated conversation at some point. But please, would either of you, Dr. Massey, Dr. Littleberry, like to take a crack at those?
I think we both have answers that are burning. one of the things that I think that the UDC teaches you is that every student that chooses UDC is not able to be characterized. And so one of the things that I found out early on in my tenure at UDC, and I've been here 30 plus years, is that there are not demographic characteristics that say to me that the student's going to need an A, a B, or a C. And so I've had students who have been decades older than the youngest student in my class, been considerably more technologically savvy, been considerably more independent in their ability to navigate the coursework, been considerably more. And so I think that of our classroom. And so as we've been working really to create a sense of learning community where everybody gets to come in and either be or remake who they want to be in that space, and we're there to really fold around that, I understand your question and I do appreciate it, and I do think that there are responsibilities that we have to think in front of what the opportunities may be, what the needs may be. But I think that I have best served in the roles that I've had in academic affairs when I have given students the opportunity to be a blank slate before me and kind of direct me around the ways that they need to be supported.
Thank you. Dr. Littlebear?
Yes, I would to echo in part what Dr. Massey has already said, that we take students as they are, we meet them where they are, and we are we recognize that our student body is multi-generational. And so we cannot handle everybody the same. As we think about these plans, certainly taking your question into account about how we engage students, we have to engage them differently because of where they fall. But their problems can be, their concerns or issues can be so unique. And so every student is handled based on their uniqueness, not with a cookie cutter approach to you're having a problem in class, it must fall into one, a set of categories. It is really about what is happening with that student,
is the, you know, one student might be having a problem in class. It could be housing. It could be their home environment. Another student having a housing issue in class could be housing insecurity. And then what can we do to help that student or support that student in that way? So we really take the time to engage each student individually and work then to determine how we're going to assist them. What are the things that we need to do to be able to help them?
Great. And to be clear, you're talking to the alumni representative, so I have the lived experience, and so I'm not asking for cookie cutter, but I am asking for the issues to be addressed, and so to help expedite it, some of the things, if you can send the information in advance, and then maybe we can pose our questions to you in preparation, it can help expedite this, but I think it's important that we take the time to get these answers and maybe to take a look at it. So like I said, as the alumni representative, I've had the lived experience of what it feels like and to actually get that touch. And no one mentioned that it had to be cookie cutter, but we do need to address and to reflect that these things, from that perspective, we need to get the data and the information so we can make better decisions and plans. Thank you for allowing me these extra few minutes to ask that or make those comments.
No, they were important. Thank you. Actually, it's a perfect segue to a couple of things I wanted to actually ask. One is just sort of not flip, but it may sound like it. It sounds like this committee will very much encourage the administration to continue to put the hiring of additional advisors at the top of some of our budget requests because it's an important new initiative. But Dr. Jackson, your comment about data brings me to the other point I wanted to discuss with this committee. And Dr. Eddington and I have been talking about this a little bit. And those of you who were here, but that's unfortunately no one in the committee who's new, would know that we had an outcomes task force last year, which is obviously quantitatively driven in very important ways. And so when I came to this committee, one of the topics that we discussed was merging that outcomes task force into this committee and considering adding meetings to this committee, which right now generally has only three a year. And maybe if we added at least one each term or two, a total of two, to increase our number of meetings minimally to five. Michael, I see you. Three, right?
Three more. Three more.
No, And that's there you go. There you go. As the faculty load goes down, ours goes up. But I think it would be very good for us to have separate meetings. You haven't seen the data that were accumulated last year. You may be doing this, Dr. Eddington, at the retreat, going back over the outcomes as you've done them before. But one of the things that's made me so excited by this team has been their commitment to data. And it is a very important one. And I, for one, am not very quick at grasping all those analyses. I like to have them in front of me as well and look at them and think about them and be able to work with them. But I think it will take more meetings if those of you who are involved can tolerate the thought with some focused on outcomes. And we'll try to get that as a function of this committee, plus any other members when we're meeting as an outcomes group, who anyone else from the board who might like to join that. That is, do you want to say anything about this, Dr. Eddington? So this is in formation. So, Dr. Eddington?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking about this on Friday.
And I just wanted to raise consideration.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and it's No, no, and Dr. Berzer, and as she said, so we've had extensive conversations, right? So some of this was driven by her observations of how we were working, because she chaired that student outcomes committee previously. Yeah. And then I had my own observations and perspectives, right? And so she initiated this discussion with me about, hey, how can we have more meaningful engagement around the data, student success outcomes and metrics? And then we got to this point where we said, hey, what if we take the student outcomes committee, and rather than trying, it was always difficult to get that committee to meet and have people to be there. It was difficult, right? So we said, what if we take it and put it within this committee, as she said, and then we have a new group of people on the committee who have a strong interest in the topic, and then we create more opportunities outside of the ASA committee meeting, like, right? Because you all, this is a perfect example, right? There's a lot of interesting questions. So what if we have more time with additional meetings to dive into some of those topics around strategy, best practices, data, outcomes? Yeah. And so that's what she describes how we arrived at. Yeah, maybe there's a better way to do this, because from the administration side, we welcome more opportunities to engage with the trustees on these topics, because we want to leverage what you all bring to the table to help us, and we can't do it effectively under the previous structure. It just didn't allow that, right? So we're looking for a better way to have these things, and for you all, right, you're here because you want to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Thank you. It makes no sense for outcomes to stand in isolation and to not be involved with some of the strategic initiatives that we've heard about today, and ask, well, how are those going to
That was the other thing, right? That's right. Yeah. You had these two separate conversations, one data focus,
right,
and then the strategies are over in another committee, right? So it was.
That's right. We just felt like passive recipients of outcomes data, mm-hmm, without being able to help think about them. So that's one question. The other question is, I have a bias, which I'm very happy to be told is quite old-fashioned, and you don't agree with it at all. But I wonder if you would like to meet at least some of the meetings in person rather than online, particularly when we're looking at some of these numbers. I'm thrilled with the thoughtfulness and knowledgeability of this committee. My experience is those conversations are better in person. But I don't know, this meeting went pretty well, I think. So what do you think? Do you have a preference? Oh, Franica can send a poll out. Would that be better? We'll do that. So I just raised both of these as questions for you. At that, I think we are at the end of our agenda, and I sense many pent-up questions, and so do I have, which is just wonderful. There's so much to do, and I'm very pleased to meet each of the new members and have you here. So we will be back in touch with a question and about how do you feel about in-person, and can we look at some dates for additional meetings. We'll need to think about whether the next thing we do is, in fact, look at the current statements of outcomes. That's an interesting tactical question for how we move our conversation forward. There are going to be a lot of opportunities with the retreat coming up, particularly where we go in more depth to the administration's plans. So if there are any comments either on what I've said, suggestions on how to deal with it, or further business that you'd like to raise before the committee now, please do.
Well, I was also wondering whether a meeting in person or virtually, can there be a deadline if there's any presentations, if there's anything of this nature, at least to have 72 hours or a week in advance, so we can at least absorb and be able to have thoughtful questions after we analyze and taken a look at what's going to be presented to us.
You're completely right, and I'm sure that will happen. So.
Yeah. We try to get you all materials a week in advance, at least. And so we will follow that practice with this committee.
Yes. And with my bias toward conversational engagement, intellectual engagement, I would really request that as much reporting as possible be done in writing, except for what you really want to highlight that we look at. So you can still highlight it and we can talk about it, but it helps a lot to not take the committee's time. And I don't think that happened tonight. There were a lot of really important bases and groundwork to be covered, but point well made and heard, I can tell. Thank you.
Dr. Garazzoni?
Yes.
Sorry. Good.
No, I just wanted to wrap up, but Dr. Massey was going to say something. So
I just wanted to ask on the other side, I think it would be helpful to us, when Dr. Garazzoni and I met, she actually asked for 10 days advance going forward, and so I will work to meet that. But I think it would also be helpful to Dr. Littleberry and I to actually have some of the questions in advance, because I think that if there are questions that require that we pull data or research things, then we can come to the table and there's a real conversation that can happen, everybody armed in ways that are helpful, because I think that it's hard for us to show up in real time around some of the questions. And everybody's really busy, and I know that when you ask, you want to know. And so we want to be able to be responsive.
If we had a little bit more meeting time, you know, 2 to 3 more meetings, that would also help you not feel quite so pressed to answer at the moment, I don't think. Chairperson Sessions.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Chair Garazzoni. I will not protract the length of the meeting. I wanted to listen more than talk during this committee meeting, so I'll basically just bring the benediction. I just really wanted to acknowledge and express my appreciation for the comments and questions of the newest members. Very insightful, and you know, frame of reference matters. And you're going to have a very robust and engaging committee, which helps all of us, helps management, helps trustees, and ultimately beneficiaries, the students. And so I'm very excited about the newest members, and they are coming on at a good time. We're all sort of coming in together and have an opportunity to grow together. And so Dr. Garazzoni, we'll lean on you for institutional memory as we move along.
Longer the tooth, right?
The last thing I'll say is just wanted to mention, it's an unrelated topic, but I think germane for our discussion tonight. I actually was invited and had an opportunity to participate in an aging and wellness symposium today, in which several members of the UDC faculty participated. Thank you, Dr. Massey, for surrounding them up. Dr. Fleming, who's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, was there, as well as Dr. Tiffany Gurley Nettles, who is assistant professor and heads up our language and pathology. And the reason I mention that is because it was held at a brand new affordable assisted living facility in the district. And there was a lot of data about the aging population in the district, particularly in Ward 7 and 8. And it occurred to me and to us that this is a great opportunity, and you'll hear more about it, for UDC to really engage externally, which is part of our strategic plan, with what's going on in the District of Columbia, and also to develop workforce initiatives around it. Dr. Eddington has talked about not just workforce development, but he's calling it workforce innovation. And that's what we're really going to be focusing on. And today's symposium was a great opportunity to sort of listen and learn and get ideas about how UDC can be a partner with some of the health sciences things that, particularly for aging population east of the river. So I just wanted to mention that. You'll hear more about it as we go along, but I'm excited that every time we can show up, we, University of District of Columbia, can show up, participate, and add value. We'll continue to add value to what we do. Thank you.
Super, thank you.
One announcement, a reminder, tomorrow
6 p.m., we will officially, formally swear in Dr. Jackson, Trustee Grayson, and Trustee Lopez, our three new alumni trustees. So for those that can be there, 6 p.m. in Heritage Hall, we'd love to have you. And Dr. Jackson, I look forward to meeting you in person. It was good meeting you
Likewise.
Tonight.
Likewise.
And I really want to thank Dr. Littleberry and Dr. Massey again. This is a dreadful time of year for people in academia. It is so busy. You see, the students are coming in, moving out, and so on and so forth. So thank you. I know it was a heroic effort to get all these materials together at this point in the semester, so thank you. Any other comments? No? If there being none, then do we have to call for an adjournment? But do we have a quorum? Oh, we do. Okay, then as in compliance with the law, we should do we have to have a motion? Would anyone else like to move that we adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you. I'm not supposed to second, I don't think.
Second.
Thank you. Here. I have the here we go.
Chair, motion carries.
Okay. The chair carries.
I said, Madam Chair.
The motion carries.
Motion carries.
Okay. Who's saying this?
Janet, can you call the roll? Or I can call it. Dr. Berzone?
Okay. Dr. Berzone, Trustee Jackson.
Aye.
Here.
Trustee Dannenberg.
Aye.
Trustee Odiali.
Aye.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the motion carries.
That's it. Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you. Farewell. Have a good night, everybody. Thank you so much for the great question and great participation.